solution now. Just by summing up the an arbitrary linear combination of plane waves, and then we promote the amplitudes of the plane waves to creation and inflation operators, and this would give us the quantized Dirac field. So I remind you that we found four sets of solutions for each wave number or for each momentum. So there are positive frequency modes, and negative frequency modes, denoted by V. And then the spin index takes two values, 1, 0, and 1. And so it distinguishes two spin projections of a particle in its rest frame. So it's we choose to diagonalize the Z projection of the spin. And so this is the spin label. Okay, and then they have their spinor index, so they are Coulombs of four numbers. So the general solution can be written as a Fourier integral. Mistaken in the notes, so there shouldn't be this square root factor. So then there is just the sum over spins A P S U S P minus I P X.
Square root of 2p0?
Because we chose to normalize the wave functions in such a way that their square is already contains 2e or 2n, whatever. But so it's included in the normalization of the wave function. So this is the most general solution of the Dirac equation, and then the coefficients, the amplitudes A and B become, in quantum theory, creation annihilation operators. And since the particles described by the Dirac field are fermions, this operator satisfies anti-commutation, canonical anti-commutation relations. So A and A dagger anti-commute on the delta function. And the rest of the anti-commutators is zero. So this is the creation and annihilation operators of particles that satisfy the Fermi statistics and that carry spin and charge.
So I'm a little confused about the appearance of the delta function here. In the previous, when we did scalar field theory, I understood why the delta function came in, because we were trying to express something which was an integral over the three momentum in terms of four momentum to make the Lorentz invariance manifest.
Yes.
And here, you know, we did the four different solutions of the Dirac equation, and now we should just be adding them to get a four dimension, the most general solution, right?
Yes, it's true. But in the Dirac equation, the momentum, the four momentum, must be on shell. This is a consequence of the Dirac equation, so we need to insert this delta function. It's still the creation and annihilation operators are labeled by special momentum. So it's the energy is computed by the usual dispersion relation. Then we can substitute these fields into the expression for the energy, the charge operator, and the spin. So let me write down just the energy. So the Hamiltonian of the Dirac field, which is V3x of psi bar minus I gamma I plus M psi. So this is very easy to understand. The Dirac Lagrangian contains, so it should be interpreted as kinetic energy minus potential energy. So we attribute everything with time derivatives to kinetic energy and change the sign of the rest, and this gives us the Hamiltonian. Yes?
In the anti-commutation relations, do you need another delta function for the spin component?
Yes, thank you very much. That's absolutely true. Yes, R delta S. So then we substitute the fields and do the Dirac algebra. And after some calculations, one can show that the Hamiltonian can be written as the sum or the integral over all modes times their energy and then times the number operator. And there's, of course, a vacuum energy contribution, which turns out to be negative. So 2 is the number of spin components, and okay, actually this coefficient compared to bosons, this coefficient is 4, and so for bosons we get plus 1/2, and here we have minus 2. So extra factor of 4 is just the number of degrees of freedom. So we have two particles now, described by B and U operators, and also we have two spin degrees of freedom, so this accounts for a factor of 4. The minus sign comes from Fermi statistics. Now, the significance of this minus sign, I mean, there have been many speculations concerning this minus plus signs for bosons and fermions. In particular, suppose that we take, of course we can renormalize this this energy away, although it is divergent, we can always subtract it by starting with the Lagrangian has a constant piece. But if you don't want to do it, we could still have started with a model where we have both bosons and fermions. If they have the same mass, meaning that E of P is the same, and if you take 4 bosonic degrees of freedom, then the vacuum energy will exactly cancel. Now this is not a it's not by an accident, but rather a consequence of symmetry, which is called supersymmetry. Even if one switches on interactions in particular way that doesn't break supersymmetry, the ground state energy will be always 0. Now the ground state energy doesn't play much role in quantum field theory unless we switch on gravity, because gravity interacts with energy, and if ground state energy is not 0, then it will gravitate. So for a long time it has been believed that ground state energy, or sometimes it's called the cosmological constant, is exactly equal to 0. And supersymmetry was invoked as one of the possible solutions, but unfortunately we know that in nature fermions and bosons have different masses, so there is no match between bosons and fermions, so supersymmetry should be either broken or approximate, or anyway, this cannot be used as an explanation for the vanishing ground state energy. And besides, it seems that that the ground state energy or the cosmological constant is not really equal to 0, but is very, very small. So it's positive, and its value is I don't know, 70 orders of magnitude smaller than one would expect by substituting into formula like that. So yes.
If p squared plus m squared, so if you're integrating over all momenta, shouldn't the mass be sort of negligible at pi p?
Yeah. Yes.
So I mean, you could get cancellation if the mass is completely different.
Oh, okay. That's a good point. So you get cancellation indeed. If you have an equal number of bosons and fermions, then the leading contribution, which is lambda to the power, will cancel. But then there will be a contribution proportional to lambda squared m squared. So the cancellation will not be perfect. But even for node particles, even the number of degrees of freedom doesn't match. So there, I think there are more fermions. It doesn't mean that, I mean, because we don't know all possible particles that exist in nature, because some of them may be too heavy to observable, but yeah, still there's, even the, with the number of degrees of freedom match, they have different masses, so there is no complete cancellation. So, okay, and this is one of the mysteries in physics. We don't understand why the quantum energy is so small. Or if you can interpret the cosmological constant as the vacuum energy of quantum fields. Anyway, so this was just a side remark. We can also compute the charge operator. Which turns out to be given by the sum over all oscillators, the sum over all mode number operators, but with opposite sign for A and B. So from these formulas, we conclude that A and B operators create particles with energy with mass m, so they're relativistic particles with this dispersion relation. And also, A particles have charge plus 1, and B particles have charge minus 1, right, because of this sign here. Also, if you can, one can compute the spin, and indeed show that the spin is basically, yes. No, broken symmetry, well, strictly speaking, I haven't talked about broken symmetries yet, but okay, so how should I explain this? The, if you have bosons and fermions, and they have equal masses, then there is supersymmetry. They are related by some symmetry transformation. Such is their property. Now, if their masses are not equal, there is no, I mean, the symmetry is violated. It's, the Lagrangian is no longer symmetric under supersymmetry transformations. So, and well, we know that in electrons and photons have different masses. So, there is no degeneracy between bosons and fermions in nature, at least between those that we currently know. Okay, so we conclude that A. That A creates a particle of charge and spin 1/2, and B creates a particle of charge minus 1 and also a spin 1/2. So this is actually an antiparticle of so these particles are antiparticles of each other. In particular, if we describe electrons with the Dirac field, then A S will be creation operators of electrons, and B S will be the creation operators of positrons. Now, yes.
go back. How exactly does one get that first loop, the Hamiltonian?
This equation?
Yes.
Well, then you start with the Lagrangian.
So this would be psi bar pi non-zero d zero psi minus pi plus pi gamma I d pi. Side bar I gamma I di psi, and then minus m psi bar psi. Okay, so this is the Dirac Lagrangian. Then this term we interpret as a pq dot. So this is the kinetic energy of the Dirac field. And so the rest must be the potential energy with the minus sign. So the Hamiltonian is just a minus of that.
Sorry, what's the sign in the front of the second term that we have plus?
Sign here is plus. Yes.
I mean, you have to subtract the do the Lagrange transformation on this, right?
Yes, one has to define the conjugate
the momentum, right?
For psi vector, and they turn out to be canonically conjugate, because if you differentiate with respect to d0 psi, then you get psi vector, so they are conjugate variables. So in this sense, the psi dagger is a conjugate moment of psi. We don't need to produce any new field. Okay, and then we subtract this term. So one can see that if one forms the Hamiltonian by the usual rule, momentum times velocity minus the Lagrangian, then one arrives at this Hamiltonian. And it's obvious because the what we do is, I mean, it's very easy to separate kinetic and potential energy here. Yes? The Lagrangian? Why is it zero? It's oh, you mean on the equations of motion?
Yes,
on the equations of motion it's zero, but this doesn't mean that it's zero always. The function. Yes?
Are the properties you're saying that A aggregates particle of charge T1 and spin 1/2, is that coming out of the equation somewhere, or are you just stating that?
It's coming out of the equation, so if I have by the Q operator.
Well, we created the Q operator, right? So we've created it to give a particle of charge 1? Or is it necessary?
Well, so this equation follows from the equation for the electric current, or something that we interpret as an electric current. So there is a neutral current in this theory, which is conserved. And so the charge density, which is for this current, which is its zeroth component, is psi bar gamma zero psi. So if we compute the integral over the whole space, we measure the whole charge of the system. So we know that it is conserved. And then we can express it through operators A and B by substituting the Fourier expansions for the fields. After some calculation, this gives that formula. And, okay, then
is usually the number of operators commute with, so they, when they act on the on some state with given number of particles, they just measure how many particles there are. So that is how we. This is the logic. This is the logic behind interpreting this is particles with particle charge. So now let me make a short remark about particles and antiparticles. You see that whatever field we have, there will always be, in its Fourier expansion, we always will have positive frequency modes and negative frequency modes. And then the positive frequency modes correspond to creation and negative frequency modes to annihilation operators. And then there are two possibilities. So if the field is complex, if it doesn't have any hermeticity properties, then the separators are really different. They're not conjugate to one another. So one annihilates particles, and the other creates some other particles which have the same properties, the same spin, the same energy as the particles annihilated by this operator, but opposite charges. Now there is another possibility which we encounter for the Van Gordon field, and that is when this operator is actually conjugate to the creation operator. So in this sense, the antiparticle of the Van Gordon field is the same. I mean, it's its own antiparticle, and it has to do with the hermeticity of the field operator. If you require that the field operator's emission, then these are really one and the same operator. Now, for fermions, one can also consider fermions that are hermitian, are not complex. But for them, it is impossible to define the concept charge. So those fermions are called Majorana fermions. I will not talk about them in the course, but there is such a possibility. Any questions? Okay, then I will continue with the.
The Majorana fermions, do they follow the? Do they
They do satisfy the Dirac equation, but they have effectively two components. So they satisfy some constrained version of the Dirac equation. There is one type of fermions that I would like to discuss, and those are called Weyl fermions. Or another name for them is chiral fermions. Now, in solving the Dirac equation, we separate it into upper and lower components, which are two component spinners. And we also have seen that this components transform independently under Lorentz transformation. So Lorentz generators are diagonal in this 2 by 2 decomposition. And so in principle, the left components and the right components of a spinner transform in an independent way. So let's try to see if you could separate them in the Dirac equation and formulate a theory where we only have left spinners or only right spinners. It turns out that it's indeed possible, but we have to set mass to zero. So we need to consider massless fermions. Now, of course, what I'll be talking about is valid exactly for fermions whose mass is equal to zero, but it will be also true approximately in the case where we consider energies and momenta which are much larger than mass. So approximately we can consider a fermion massless if it's moving very fast close to the speed of light. So then the considerations that follow will be also useful. Now, if we neglect, so let's write down the Dirac equation. And then we neglect the mass term, set it to zero. So then the Dirac equation in this basis takes a very simple form. And you see that the left and right components indeed decouple. So they satisfy independent equations. Right, because the mass term, so in the Dirac equation, there's the mass. The mass would stand here and mix psi left with psi left with psi right. But if mass is zero, then there is no mixing, and they propagate independently. Now, moreover, for the massless fermions, energy is just equal to momentum, to the absolute value of momentum, and we can rewrite this equation in the following way. So we can introduce a vector n, which is a unit vector in the direction of motion of the fermion, divide through this equation by the absolute value of p, so e is equal to absolute value of p, and finally we'll see that n times sigma over 2 acting on psi left or right is equal to plus minus 1/2 psi left or right. So this is just another way to write down the Dirac equation, but the interpretation of this equation is, it has a very transparent interpretation. So the operator, the one particle operator n times sigma over 2 is called helicity, and the helicity is nothing but the projection of spin on the direction of motion. So you see that if you have a particle moving with some momentum p, then the left component of the spinner will have helicity 1/2, meaning that its spin will be directed along the equations of motion and will have fixed value s equals 1/2. So in some sense, if you imagine spin as some, I don't know, little rotator, then you can picture this particle as, okay, in some sense spinning, so the spin is rotating in such a way that so the internal momentum of the particle is such that its projection, the projection of the of its internal angular momentum of the directional motion is a fixed number equals to 1/2. So in other words, the Dirac equation just tells us that for the massless particle, helicity takes a given particular value. So it's equal to plus 1/2 for the left moving particles, or for the particles with left chirality, and minus 1/2 for spinners with right chirality. So this would be a left-handed spinner. And for the right-handed spinner, the projection will be opposite. One can picture it as a spiral rotating in an opposite direction. Yeah. It's well accepted. So.
Textbook is also the other way around.
What?
In the textbook it was also
Yeah, I just probably blindly copied it from there. No, but wait a minute. I think it was right before. Right? So if you go that way and rotate clockwise, then the spin will be positive.
So the right hand rule just go, and then the way when you hit it around, it should be right hand rule. That's what the right hand
rule. I don't understand. So if I'm moving that way and rotating right hand like that,
yeah, that should be
positive spin.
That should be right hand as well, because you're right hand.
So right handed meaning rotating clockwise. Right? So this should be picture like that. So it should moving forward and rotate clockwise like that, right? Well, just a second. Oh, yeah, that's correct. Yeah, I think this is correct. And this should be like that. Right-handed is the one that rotates. So if you go forward and rotate clockwise, okay? So that's right-handed. Left-handed is the opposite.
So if you label
it, so the top one should be right-handed. The arrow is going in the right direction, but that's using your left.
Oh, okay. So yeah. Yes. Yeah. So you should. correct way to think of this is to look at the equation, right? So it's okay, so anyway, the important point is that helicity has an eigen, has a definite value for spinners of different helicity. Different helicity. And whatever you think, the one that has plus here is called left-handed. So it's just a definition. Anyway, then, so this was the Dirac equation, and you see that the Dirac equation is independent for left and right components. The question is whether this equation is Lorentz invariant and how to separate left moving and, left handed and right handed fermions in a Lorentz invariant way. So that can be done with the projection that's called Chiral projection. Which can be defined using another Dirac matrix, which has a special name for it, and which is I times the product of all other Dirac matrices. So this matrix has a number of important properties. So first of all, it anti-commutes with all other Dirac matrices. This is because if you try to pull it through the any Dirac matrix, say gamma zero, if you pull it through this expression, we change the sign each time we hit one of those three, but then it commutes with itself, so we change the sign three times, and the same is true for any other Dirac matrix. Now, this matrix turns out to be a pseudoscalar, so it whereas all other Dirac matrices are vectors, this is a pseudoscalar. And this can be explained in the following way. So we can write gamma 5 is I divided by 4 factorial times the contraction with an absolutely antisymmetric tensor of fourth rank. So the equivalence of this representation to that follows from the fact that only the components, so epsilon has is defined in such a way that epsilon 1, 2, 3 is equal to plus 1, and then all the other non-zero components are obtained by permutations of the indices, where the permutation is odd, then the sign is minus 1. If it's even, then the sign is plus 1. And then permutation of indices here follows the same rule, because all this matrix is anti-commute, so if it transpose any two of them, then gamma 5 will only change the sign. So these two representations are equivalent. Now the epsilon tensor transforms as a, it's a pseudo-tensor. So if we transform it to another reference frame by the usual tensor rules, Then there, so one can prove that contracting contracting the indices on arbitrary matrices, also in Lorentz transformation matrices in particular, produces the same epsilon tensor but multiplied by the determinant of the matrix. So if the determinant is positive, so if we're dealing with the proper Lorentz transformations, then epsilon would stay invariant. But then there are Lorentz transformations that change which have determinant that's equal to minus one, and then those transformations epsilon changes sign. So such objects are called pseudotensors. So I guess you should be familiar from these pseudotensors from ordinary three-dimensional physics. For instance, the magnetic field is a pseudotensor, or spin is a pseudotensor, angular momentum is a pseudotensor. So they're pseudovectors, I'm sorry. So if you change the directions of all axes, do a mirror transformation, then magnetic field will change sign, and the spin changes sign, or the angular momentum changes sign. So these are examples of pseudovectors. Yes?
The gamma and mu, those are scalars under Lorentz transformation, right?
Those are vectors. I mean,
is that
effectively they are vectors. So if you sandwich them between the
right,
spinners,
then
they will transform as vectors.
Yeah.
So the same is true for gamma 5. So if you sandwich it between
two
psi's,
then it's a pseudoscalar.
It will produce a pseudoscalar. So indeed, psi bar gamma 5, psi bar is a pseudoscalar. So if you do a proper Lorentz transformation, then it will stay the same in all reference frames. But if we say do a parity transformation, then this will change the sign. So likewise, gamma 5, gamma mu is a pseudovector. And so on. Now, if you compute how gamma 5 looks in the chiral basis, then it has it is just a diagonal matrix with ones and minus ones in the diagonal. And so we can form chiral projections, projectors. So if we define this operator, so this will be given by either 1, 0 or 0, 1. So these are chiral projectors. If you apply such a projector on a spinner field, on any spinner, then it will pick up either left or right components. So we can define left and right components in a more invariant way by acting with this current projectors on the four component spin. So, which means that picking up left and right components of a spinner is more or less a Lorentz invariant procedure, right? So under proper Lorentz transformations, the left hand side will transform as usual. So I mean that we use the projector behaves well under proper Lorentz transformations. If you do a parity transformation, the projectors will change, the gamma phi will change sign. This means that parity interchanges left and right terms, right, the various components of SP, which is also clear from this picture. So helicity is flipped. Parity obviously flips helicity because spin is a pseudo vector. So if you look at the particle with helicity 1/2 in the mirror, it will be at -1/2. It will have helicity -1/2. Okay, so then of course. We can try to formulate the theory without with only one component of spinners. So the spinners are called wild spinners. It's two component spinners that are projected onto definite chirality components. And we can write down this Lagrangian. So the Lagrangian, since it can be written, so let's check that it is indeed Lorentz invariant. Well, we just substitute psi left as a projection of a four component spinner. And we know how the four component spinners transform. So and we should figure out what is psi left. This would be psi dagger gamma zero left. And this is equal to psi left 1 minus gamma 5/2. Because this is a Hermitian matrix, this projection is a Hermitian projection projector. But then, if anti-commutes with gamma 5, gamma 0 anti-commutes with gamma 5. So if you pull it through, then you will see that the projection here is changed sign. Yes.
We're using the same notation for psi left a two-component spinner and psi left a four-component spinner on which we have acted with the projection operator.
Yeah.
So to make sense of psi bar left, we'll have to think of it in terms of four-component spinners, or can we think of it as two-component spinner multiplied by some 2x2 matrix?
It might be confusing indeed. One can make sense of it as a two-component object, but it is better. It is better to think of it this way.
Okay.
So anyway, then we can write the Lagrangian as I psi left bar psi bar 1 plus gamma 5/2, then gamma mu. Psi left, which is 1 minus gamma 5/2 psi. And then we can pull gamma mu to the right.
and then use the fact that this is a projector. So first of all, gamma 5 changes sign when we anti-commute through gamma mu. And then the square of this is equal to 1. It equal to the same current projection. So then we get this Lagrangian, which is manifestly invariant under Lorentz transformations, but not under paired. So this gives a theory that is not paired invariant because it doesn't have bright spinners in the theory. Thrown them away, and parity interchanges left and right. Now the question is it useful at all? Because we know that most common laws of nature are invariant under parity. Maxwell's equations, Einstein's equations.
So you're missing a derivative from the last.
Yes.
So derivative should be there. But it turns out that nature doesn't miss this opportunity to be not invariant under parity. So indeed, weak interactions, weak nuclear interactions, act differently on left and right components of various fermions, including electrons. And neutrinos. And when we are dealing with the weak interactions, it is actually necessary to separate left and right compounds because the interaction terms are different for left and right projections of the electron wave function. Now, for neutrinos, the situation is even worse in a sense, because neutrinos do have only two components. So they are chiral particles, so they are described, they don't have charge. Okay, so they have neutrinos and antineutrinos. Neutrinos have only one, so they're described by two component fermions. However, neutrinos are it's clear that they have mass, and so one indeed can add a mass term to this Lagrangian, which is different from the mass term for electrons, and this mass term breaks many symmetries, including parity. So let us see that if we that the usual mass term, so the mass operator is psi bar psi, cannot be defined for chiral fermions or Weyl fermions. So we can write one as a sum of two orthogonal projectors, and then this can be written as psi right times psi left right plus psi bar left, psi, right. Okay, so you see that the mass term indeed mixes left components of fermions with the right components, and right with left. And so once we need both of them to define this this type of mass term. Do you have any questions about this? Yes?
I'm still a little confused about how you're moving in between the two components. Can you just talk about what you were saying?
Okay, so let's say that we define psi left and psi right as four component spinners, but satisfying this equation. Okay? So that effectively that leaves only two components in them, because this matrix have a form of a projector. So psi left then has this form. So it has something here and a zero here. So the best way to think of them at the moment is just like that. And then here we have four component spinners, but projected with this operator. So we need to write it explicitly in this form. And so one can think of them as four component objects, but satisfying this condition. So in this sense, this equation is also written in terms of four component spinners, but projected onto upper and lower components. Yes?
Can't I just add a mass term that will be left-handed, bar left-handed, and the mass term? There is no reason I should work only with four components.
Yes, indeed, such mass term can be defined. That is true. One can define a mass term in a different way, but you cannot write it in terms of, it's difficult to write it in terms of four component spinners.
Yes, you have to use two components.
Yeah. There is a different mass term for that, so there's no one strict. It's called Myron mass term, and indeed it exists. Yes?
What's the difference between a scalar and a pseudo-scalar?
Their transformations under parity. So if you transform a pseudo-scalar into reference frame where we change the directions of all axes, it changes something. An example from non-relativistic physics is a scalar product of electric and magnetic field. Right, so that would be observed to the scale. So now let me, the 10 minutes remaining. I wanted to say a few words about condensed matter applications of the Dirac equation, mainly because this year's Nobel Prize went to the discovery of graphene, and graphene is described by the Dirac equation. I mean, electrons in graphene are described by the Dirac equation. But that gives me an opportunity to say a few words about relationship between relativistic fields like the Dirac field and non-relativistic second quantized system with which we started in the first lecture. Yes? You have a question? Sorry. So the one big difference is that in the non-relativistic system, the field operator that we have introduced was given by, there was some creation operator or annihilation operator times perhaps some wave function. There will be a negative oscillating exponent. So if we consider a field, say, in Heisenberg representation, then for the field operator, we'll have something like that. And there is a big difference compared to relativistic fields in that we only have annihilation operators here, right? So we define the field operator by Fourier transforming the annihilation operator. In particular, the field operator X trivially on the vacuum. Vacuum is an empty state, and that is, it's an eigenstate of the annihilation operators. So this is a big difference, because in relativistic field theories, we always have negative and positive modes in the expansion of the of any field, and therefore we have always creation and annihilation operators in the same field, which means that the empty state is never the eigenstate of the field operator. Now, it might seem to be a bit a serious difference, but on the other hand, in condensed matter theory, we are not interested in the empty state usually. We are interested in the state where we have many particles. So, for instance, if we are thinking of electrons in a piece of metal, then we fill all energy levels up to Fermi energy. So the electrons have some band structure in the metal, and then there is a Fermi energy, and all the levels below the Fermi energy are occupied. While the levels over the Fermi energy are empty. So this is what we'll have in metal. And it, I mean, the difference between metal and insulator is in the position of the Fermi surface. So the Fermi surface turns out to lie between the bands, then the material will be an insulator or a semiconductor. There is actually no sharp distinction between an insulator and a semiconductor. In a semiconductor, the Fermi surface is close to either occupied band or to the empty band. In either case, there is a finite energy gap between occupied levels and empty levels. Yes?
What's the horizontal direction?
Sorry?
What does the horizontal direction mean?
It's a cartoon in a sense. Well, of course, in the real metal, one has to draw it in four dimensions. So it should be energy as a function of three components of momentum. Horizontal direction is momentum. Now, at the boundary of the zone, the energy should have a minimum or a maximum. And so this is, anyway, so this is the picture, this is a general picture. So in the metal, it costs no energy to create an excitation, that's why they conduct current easily. An insulator requires a finite amount of energy to create just one excitation, and therefore they conduct current, but with much greater effort. The point here is that many, many levels are occupied. And now for fermions, actually, there is no big distinction between creation and annihilation operators. Because let's consider a very simple example of a two-level system. when you have just one creation and one annihilation operator, right? So there is an empty state or occupied state, and there is some energy gap between them, so that the Hamiltonian is epsilon b dagger b. Right, so then it's natural to, so this Hamiltonian annihilates the empty state, and the occupied state is its eigenvalue with, is its eigenstate with the eigenvalue epsilon. But now imagine that epsilon is negative. Then we would better say that the occupied state is our ground state and the empty state is the excited state. Well, but this can be, okay, we can go back to this, to this normal situation when epsilon is positive by just relabeling our operator. So we call B the creation operator and B dagger an annihilation operator. Right? So the algebra doesn't change because here we have an anti-commutator. An anti-commutator is invariant under this relabeling. Unlike the commutator, for the commutator, if you relabel this, the operators in this way, we would get the minus sign on the right hand side. And then H will be equal to minus epsilon B Tweedle dagger B Tweedle. So I just interchange the order of operators. Then there will be, let's see, minus plus epsilon. So we can write that H is equal to absolute value of epsilon B dagger B, and then plus ground state energy, which is negative. So this is sometimes called particle Hall transformation. So in the normal situation where that particle has positive energy, the operator B annihilates particle, and B dagger creates a particle. So it's, and they form this algebra. Now, when we relabel them, we can say that B dagger, that we better occupy. So if the energy is negative, it's energetically more favorable to have a particle in the state. But then if we act by our new creation operator, which in the older term means that we remove this particle, we can say that we create a hole. So we can use this particle Hall transformation here. So we can say that the creation operators below the Fermi level are actually annihilation operators of Halls. And then our field operator will have a form which is actually more close to the one for say Dirac field operator in the relativistic theory. So because then we will have uh, So this would be for energies lower, larger than Fermi energy. And then for energies lower than the Fermi energy, we can, if you do a particle Hall transformation, then we will have also creation operators of Hall in the field operator. Okay, so for in a metal, the lowest excitations are holes and electrons. So we can, the ground state is when just all levels below the Fermi level are occupied. But then we can take out an electron from the Fermi C and put it in one of the unoccupied levels. So from the point of view of so field theory, this would correspond to two excitations. So we would call this state that contains one electron and one hole. And in principle, they can propagate separately and independently. So it's better to think of them as two independent excitations. Now, so the actual structure of the Fermi surface and of the I mean of the dispersion curve here depends very much on what material you're dealing with. And certainly there is no relativistic symmetry, so the dispersion relation is not the same as in the Dirac equation. However, in graphene, effectively, the dispersion relation becomes at low energies is the same as it effectively has relativistic symmetry. So this happens because graphene has so graphene is a one layer, one atomic layer of graphite. So it's essentially a two-dimensional material. And for some reasons, the Fermi surface of, or the dispersion curve of the graphene has a very peculiar structure. So there are two points where, okay, the dispersion curve has a linear form. So now this this is a plane of a two-dimensional momentum in the plane of this graphite sheet, and this is energy as a function of momentum. And so there are two points where the energy is linear in momentum. And moreover, all the levels below, so the Fermi level is such that it crosses these points. So that this is also the Fermi level. So the excitations as a result effectively have linear dispersion relation. If we shift all momenta close to this point, so we can say that this is P1, and then we can redefine the momentum. So we can say that P is P minus P1. So then the dispersion is just linear. But of course, the coefficient here, so in the Dirac field, the coefficient was 1. But in practice, it wasn't 1, it was the speed of light. Here it is the Fermi velocity, which in graphene is about 300 times smaller than the speed of light. So anyway, if you write down the field theory of graphene, it will be described by just the Dirac fermions. Actually, there will be two of them because there are two points. There are two Dirac points. They are called Dirac points. And basically, the properties of graphene as a conductor are completely determined by, or largely determined by, the fact that that is described by the Dirac type dispersion relation. Okay, yes?
Is the psi a two component Pauli spinner? Started it or?
Oh, for the graphene?
Yeah.
Well, let's see. So, psi is actually, effectively, it's four compounds. So, because it is two compounds at each of the Dirac points, and then because there are two of them, it doubles the number of compounds. Four compounds. Well, thank you. That's it for today.